As time passed and they journeyed on, they slowly lost their religion, literally. They turned to a new hope for answers. Science. They were tired of myths and allegories. They wanted proof. And they began to find it. But they paid a high price for it. Science lacks something very important that religion provides. A moral code. Survival of the fittest is a scientific fact. But it is a cruel ethic. The way of beasts, not a civilized society. Laws can only take us so far. And they must be based upon something. A shared moral code that rises from something. As that moral foundation recedes, so will society's values. I don't think a person has to be religious to be moral. I'm a scientist, and I'm not terribly religious, but I'm, or I think I'm, a pretty moral person. You're also much smarter and more empathetic than the vast majority of people. But they will catch up to you someday, and the world will live in peace, without the need for allegories or moral lessons. I fear that day is further away than anyone believes. I speak of the state of things today, of the masses, not the minority. But I shouldn't be speaking of any of it. I'm preaching about subjects of interest to me, as old men often do, especially lonely ones. You've no doubt guessed the identity of the monks who split from the Imaru so long ago? The Imari. Chian nodded. We believe that around the time of the Greeks, the separatist monks changed their name to the Imari, perhaps to sound more Greek, so they might be accepted by the Greek scholars who were making so many breakthroughs in this emerging field of science. The true tragedy, and the truth of how that faction changed forever, is chronicled in the journal. And that's why you must read. What about the rest of the tapestry? The other two floods? Those are events yet to come. Kate studied the other half of the tapestry. The sea that had consumed the world in the flood of water turned from blue to a crimson sea of blood as it flowed into the lower right quadrant of the tapestry. Above the sea of blood, a group of supermen were slaughtering lesser beings. The world was a wasteland. Darkness covered the land, and blood ran from every man, woman, and child into the crimson pool. The flood of blood. Above the battle, a hero fought a powerful monster, killing it, and rising into heaven, where he unleashes a flood of light, bathing the world and liberating it, including the oppressed. Taken in whole, the tapestry moved from the blacks and grays of the flood of fire to the blues and greens of the flood of water, to the reds and crimsons of the flood of blood, to the whites and yellows of the flood of light. It was truly beautiful, captivating. Chien interrupted her concentration. And now I must rest. And you must do your homework, Dr. Warner. Chapter 70. Main Conference Room, Clock Tower HQ, New Delhi, India. Dorian held his hand up to stop the analyst. What the hell is a Barnaby Prendergast report? The 30-something man looked confused. It's the report from Barnaby Prendergast. Dorian glanced around the conference room at the assembled clock tower and Imari security personnel. The now integrated staff were still adjusting to the formal Imari Clock Tower Union, and it was slowing the meeting down as roles and jurisdictions were settled. Can someone please tell me what Barnaby Prendergast is? Oh, that's his name. Barnaby Prendergast, the analyst said. Seriously? Did we give him that name? Actually, don't tell me. I don't care. He said what? Start over. The analyst flipped a few stapled pages over. Prendergast is one of about 20 staffers still on site. Was on site, Dorian corrected. The analyst cocked his head. Well, technically he is, or his dead body is on site. Jesus Christ, just give me the fucking report. The analyst swallowed. Right, before the drone strike, he, Prendergast, said an unidentified female, his words were, accosted him outside his lab and coerced him into aiding her in what she claimed was a rescue of some children. The analyst flipped another page. He goes on to say he tried to stop her and that he believed she was using a fake or stolen ID card. Also, here's the kicker. He also says she ran out after the attacks, quote, covered in blood, but unharmed, and that she attacked him again, stopped him from rescuing workers, blah, 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 and then she took a security guard's gun, tried to shoot him, Prendergast, that is, then got on the cargo train with a dying accomplice, who Prendergast said had been shot multiple times. Dorian leaned back in the chair and stared at the bank of screens. Kate Warner had survived the bell. How? Reed was likely dead. Dorian had practically turned the fool into a block of Swiss cheese. The man cleared his throat. Sir, should we disregard? You think it's bullshit? Maybe the guy was playing for the spotlight?
No, I don't.
Dorian bit into one of his nails. It's too fucking elaborate to be made up. Wait, why do you say playing for the spotlight? Prendergast made a call to the BBC right before the strike. That's how we got the report. We were monitoring all the communications in and out of the facility since the accident. We have him on our list to discredit. His story threatens Imari's earlier industrial accident press release, so...
Okay, stop. Stop right there. One thing at a time. Let's focus here.
Dorian swiveled his chair to face Dr. Chang, who sat in the corner, staring at the conference room's cheap carpet.
Chang, pay attention.
Dr. Chang sat up as if the teacher had called on him. The man had been frazzled and absent since the blast in China.
Yes, I'm here.
For now you are, Doctor. But if you don't figure out how Kate Warner survived the bell, you won't be.
Chang shrugged his shoulders.
I can't even begin to...
You will begin to.
How could she have survived?
Chang brought a closed hand to his face and cleared his throat.
Well, let's see. She could have treated herself with whatever she gave the children. Maybe she tested it for safety.
Dorian nodded.
Interesting. Other possibilities?
No.
Well, there is the obvious that she could have already had immunity, the Atlantis gene. Dorian chewed his nail some more. That was very interesting. Very interesting.
Okay, that one sounds easy to test.
Chang shook his head.
My lab was destroyed, and we don't even know where to start.
Get a new lab.
Dorian turned to one of his staffers.
Find Dr. Chang a new lab.
He focused again on Chang.
And I'm not a scientist, but I would start by sequencing her genome and checking for any irregularities.
Chang nodded.
Yes, of course, that's easy, but with the state of the site, we're not likely to find any DNA.
Dorian threw his head back.
For God's sake, think outside the box. She has a condo in Jakarta. Surely you're clever enough to find a hairbrush or a used tampon, doctor.
Chang flushed.
Yes, that could work.
A female clock tower analyst spoke up.
Some women flush their tampons.
Dorian closed his eyes and held his hands up.
Forget the fucking tampon.
There must be tons of Kate Warner's DNA in Jakarta. Go find some. Or better yet, let's find her. If she did escape, she's got to be on one of the trains.
Dorian turned to Dmitry Kozlov,
the Imari security field commander who had left China with him.
The soldier shook his head. I just got the list. We checked it against the staff roster. She's not on any of the trains, and neither is Reed. We've got a lot of injured and dead, several people with trauma wounds, but nobody with gunshot wounds.
You're shitting me. Search the trains again.
It will delay Toba, Dmitry said.
Do it.
The analyst with the Prendergast report piped in.
She could have jumped.
Dorian rubbed his temples.
She didn't jump.
The analyst shook his head.
How do you know?
Because she had Reed with her.
She could have pushed him off.
Could have, but didn't.
The analyst looked confused.
How do you know?
Because she's not as stupid as you apparently are.
She's 5'8", 120 pounds. Reed is over 6 feet and at least 180.
Warner couldn't hike out of Tibet on her own, much less hauling 180 pounds of dead weight, and trust me, if Reed is alive, he can't walk. She could have left him. She wouldn't leave him. How do you know? Because I know her. Look, let's wrap this up. Come on, move out, people.
Dorian stood and waved his arms to usher people out of the crowded room.
What about the Barnaby Prendergast report?
The analyst said.
What about it?
Should we contradict?
Hell no, confirm it.
The media will run with it anyway. It has the word terrorist in it.
And it's the truth. A terrorist attacked our facility in China. It's the best break we've had. Release the footage of Reed planting the bombs to corroborate it. Tell the press that the attack follows an earlier attack by the same people in Jakarta. Include video of Warner as well.
Dorian thought for a moment. This could work out well. Maybe buy them some time and provide a cover story.
Let's say we're currently investigating whether Dr. Warner deployed a biological weapon at the facility, and we're asking for a strict quarantine of the site.
Dorian waited, staring at the staff.
Okay, tick-tock, people, let's go.
He pointed at Dimitri.
You stay.
The tall soldier lumbered over to Dorian as the room cleared.
Someone took them off the train.
Agree.
Dorian paced back to the table.
It has to be them.
Impossible. We've searched those mountains non-stop since 9/11. They're not there. They were all killed in 38. Or they could be a myth. Maybe the Imaru never existed at all.
You have a better idea,
Dorian said.
When Dimitri didn't respond, Dorian continued.
I want teams searching those mountains.
I'm sorry, sir, we don't have the manpower.
The clock tower purge plus the end of major hostilities in Afghanistan, our forces in the region were already minimal. Everyone we have local is focused on Toba. If you want teams, they have to be diverted.
No, Toba is the priority.
What about satellite surveillance? Can we track them? Figure out where they are?
Dimitri shook his head.
We've got no eyes in the sky over western China. Nobody does. That's one of the reasons Imari Research selected that site. There's nothing there and no reason to look. No cities, hill, not even many villages or roads. We can reposition satellites, but it will take time.
Do that. And launch the rest of the drones in Afghanistan.
All of them.
Have them scour every inch of the plateau, focus on the monasteries first, and reassign 2 men. We can spare them.
Toba is important, but so is capturing Warner. She survived the Bell. We have to know why.
Have those 2 men trace the route of every train that left, question villagers, anyone that may have seen anything. Apply pressure. I want her found.
Chapter 71. Imaru Monastery, Tibet Autonomous Region. David was still asleep when Kate returned to his room. She sat down at his feet on the twin bed in the alcove and looked out the window for a while. The serenity of this place was like nothing she'd ever experienced. She glanced back at David. He looked almost as peaceful as the green valley and the white-top mountains. Kate leaned against the alcove wall and stretched out her legs next to his. She opened the journal and a letter fell out. The paper felt old, fragile, like Chien. The letters flowed in thick, dark ink, and she could feel the indentations on the back of the page like braille. Kate began reading aloud, hoping David would hear and that the voice would comfort him.
To the Imaru. I have become a servant to the faction you know as the Imari. I am ashamed of the things I have done, and I fear for the world, and for the things I know they are planning. At this moment, in 1938, they seem unstoppable. I pray that I am wrong. In the event I am not, I'm sending you this journal. I hope you can use it to prevent the Imari Armageddon. Patrick Pierce, November 15th, 1938.
April 15th, 1917, Allied Hospital, Gibraltar. When they pulled me out of the tunnel on the Western Front and brought me to this field hospital a month ago, I thought I was saved.
but this place has grown on me like a cancer, eating me from the inside out, silently at first, without my knowledge, then taking me by surprise, plunging me into a dark sickness I can't escape. The hospital is almost quiet at this hour, and that's when it's most scary. The priests come every morning and every night, praying, taking confessions, and reading by candlelight. They've all gone now, as have the nurses and doctors. Outside my room I can hear them, out in the wide open ward with rows of beds. Men scream, most from pain, some from bad dreams. Others cry, talk, and play cards in the moonlight and laugh, as if half a dozen men won't die before sunrise. They gave me a private room, put me here. I didn't ask for it, but the door closes and blocks out the cries and the laughs, and I'm glad. I don't like hearing either. I reach for the bottle of laudanum, drink till it runs down my chin, and drift into the night. The slap brings me back to life, and I see a jagged set of rotten teeth inside a wicked grin on an unshaven, dirty face.
He's awake.
The putrid smell of alcohol and disease turns my head and stomach. Two other men drag me out of bed, and I scream in pain when the leg hits the ground. I writhe on the floor, fighting not to pass out as they laugh. I want to be awake when they kill me. The door opens, and it's the nurse's voice. What's going on? They grab her and slam the door.
Just having a bit of fun with that senator's boy, ma'am. But you's a mite bit prettier than he is.
The man wraps his arm around her and slides behind her.
Might be we start with you, missy.
He rips her dress and undergarments from the left sleeve all the way to her waist. Her breasts fall out, and she raises an arm to cover herself. She fights back desperately with the other arm, but the man catches it and quickly pins it behind her. The sight of her naked body seems to energize the drunken men. I struggle to stand, and as soon as I reach my feet, the closest man is on me. He has a knife out, and it's at my throat. He stares me straight in the eyes while he blathers on drunkenly.
Big Daddy, Senator Daddy, done sent him off to war. Done sent us all, but he can't save you no more.
A knife bites at my neck as the crazed man glares at me. The other man holds the nurse from behind, craning his head around, trying to kiss her as she turns away. The last man undresses. Standing on the leg sends waves of pain up through my body, pain so bad it makes me nauseated, lightheaded. I will pass out soon. It's unbearable, even through the laudanum. The laudanum, worth more than gold in a place like this. I motion to the table, trying to break the man's stare. There's laudanum, a full bottle, on the table. His concentration breaks for an instant, and I have the knife. I draw it across his neck as I spin him around, then I push him away and lunge knife out for the naked man, burying the knife to the hilt in his stomach. I land on top of him, jerk the knife out, and plant it in his chest. His arms flail and blood gurgles from his mouth. The pain from the lunge is overtaking me. I've got nothing left for the last man, the nurse's captor. But his eyes go wide, and he turns the nurse loose and runs from the room, just as I pass out. 2 days later, I wake up in a different place, like a cottage in the country. That's how it smells, and how the sun feels shining in through the open window. It's a bright bedroom, decorated like a woman would, with knick-knacks and small things women like, and men never notice except for times like this. And there she is, reading in the corner, rocking silently, waiting. Through some sixth sense, she seems to instantly know that I'm awake. She sets the book down gently, like it's a piece of fine china, and walks to the bedside.
"Hello, Major."
She glances down at my left leg, nervous.
"They had to operate on your leg again.
I noticed the leg now. It's bandaged, thick, almost double the width of my leg. When they brought me in, and for 2 weeks after, they threatened to take it off.
You'll thank us later. Have to trust us, old boy. Seems horrid, but it's for the best. You won't be alone at home, I'll guarantee you that. Be tons of youngsters back from war, scootin' this way and that on tin legs. Just as common as a drink of water, I tell you. I try to lean forward to get a peek, but the pain meets me as I rise, grabbing me and throwing me flat on my back again. It's still there. I insisted they respect your wishes, but they removed a lot of the tissue. They said it was infected and would never heal. The hospital is a bad place for germs, and after... She swallows. They said you'll be in bed for 2 months. The men? Deserters, they think. There's to be an inquiry, but a formality, I presume. I see it now, the white bottle on the table, just like it was in the hospital. I linger on it. I know she sees me. You can take that out of here. If I start again, I'll never stop. I know where that road goes. She steps forward and grabs it quickly, as if it were about to fall off the table. What's her name? God, the last month is a blur. An opium and alcohol-ridden dream, a nightmare. Barnes? Barrett? Barnett? Are you hungry? She stands there, clutching the bottle to her chest with one hand, holding her dress with the other. Maybe it's the drugs or having gone so long without food, but I have no desire whatsoever to eat. Starving, I say. It'll just be a minute. She's halfway out the door. Nurse, is it? She stops and glances back, maybe a little disappointed. Barton. Helena Barton. 20 minutes later, I smell cornbread, pinto beans, and country ham. The smell of it is better than anything I've ever tasted. To my own amazement, I eat 3 plates that night. I was hungry after all. Chapter 72. Main Conference Room, Clock Tower HQ, New Delhi, India. Dorian read through the list of living and dead from the 2 trains. I want to send more bodies to the U.S. Europe looks okay, I think. He scratched his head. I think the allotment to Japan should suffice as well. The population density will help. He wished he could consult Chang or one of the scientists, but he needed to limit access to the information. Dmitri studied the list. We can still reallocate, but where should we pull them from? Africa and China. I think they'll move slower than we think. China tends to ignore or suppress public health crises, and Africa simply has no infrastructure to deal with an outbreak. Or spread it. That's one of the reasons we assigned. Developed nations, they're the real threat. Don't underestimate the CDC. They'll move fast when it hits. And we can always work on Africa after it starts. Chapter 73. Kate held David's head up as he swallowed the antibiotics with water from the ceramic cup. The last of the water ran from his mouth, and she wiped it away with her shirt. He had drifted in and out of consciousness the entire morning. She opened the journal again. I lead my men through the tunnel, holding the candle in front of me. We're almost there, but I stop, holding my hands up as the men stumble into the back of me. Did I hear something? I plant my tuning fork in the ground and watch it, waiting for the verdict. If it vibrates, the Germans are tunneling near us. We've already abandoned 2 passages for fear of connecting with them. The second one we blew up under them, hopefully stopping their progress. The fork doesn't move. I stuff it back into my tool belt, and we trudge deeper into the darkness, the candle casting faint shadows on the walls of dirt and stone. Dust and pebbles fall on our heads as we walk. Then the constant rain of grime stops. I look up and hold my candle closer, trying to discern what's happened. I turn and shout, "Get back!" as the ceiling collapses and hell pours through. The faint light of the candles winks out as I'm thrown to the ground. The falling rubble crushes my leg, and I almost pass out. The Germans land on their feet, practically on top of me, and begin firing, killing 2 of my men instantly.
The muzzle flashes of their machine guns and the screams of the dying man are my only guide to the carnage. I pull my sidearm and fire at them from point-blank range, killing the first two men, who must have either thought I was dead or couldn't see me in the darkness. More men are pouring through, and I shoot them too. 5, 6, 7 of them dead, but there's an endless line of them, never stopping, a whole regiment, ready to pour through the tunnel and behind the Allied lines. It will be a massacre. I'm out of rounds. I toss the empty pistol aside and take out a grenade. I pull the pen with my teeth and hurl it with all my might into the German tunnel above, at the feet of the newest wave of soldiers. 2 long seconds tick by as the men jump down, firing at me as they come, and then the explosion racks them, collapses their tunnel, and brings both tunnels down around me. I'm pinned. I can't get up, and won't ever get out. The debris is suffocating me, but there are hands on me, too. The nurse is there, wiping the sweat from my brow and holding my head. They were waiting on us, connected to our tunnel in the night. Didn't have a chance, I say, trying to explain. It's all over. It's only a bad dream. I reach down to the leg, as if touching it will stop the throbbing pain. The nightmare isn't over. Won't ever be over. The sweating and the pain have gotten worse each night. She must see it. And she does. The white bottle is in her hand, and I say, just a little bit. I've got to get free of it. I take a swig, and the beast backs away, and I get some real sleep. She's there when I wake, knitting in the corner. On the table beside me, 3 small shot glasses hold the dark brown liquid, the day's ration of the opium-infused concoction that delivers the morphine and codeine that I desperately need. Thank God. The sweats are back, and the pain has come with it. I'll be home before sundown. I nod and take the first shot. 2 shot glasses each day. She reads to me every night, after work and dinner. I lie there, adding clever comments and witty remarks from time to time. She laughs, and when I've been a little too crude, chastises me playfully. The pain is almost bearable. 1 shot per day. Freedom. Almost. But the pain persists. I still can't walk. I've spent my life in mines, in dark, confined spaces, but I can't take it. Maybe it's the light or the fresh air, or lying in bed day after day, night after night, a month gone by. Every day as 3 o'clock draws near, I count down the minutes until she gets home. A man waiting for a woman to get home. It calls into question the premise of the sentence. I've insisted she stop working in the hospital. Germs, bombs, chauvinists. I've tried it all. She won't hear it. I can't win. I don't have a leg to stand on. I simply can't put my foot down. And on top of that, I'm losing it, making lame jokes about myself to myself. Out the window, I see her coming down the path. What time is it? 2:30? She's early. And there's a man with her. In the month I've been here, she's never brought a suitor home. The thoughts never occurred to me, and now it strikes me in all the wrong ways. I strain to get a better look out the window, but I can't see them. They're already in the house. I frantically straighten my bed and push myself up through the dull pain so I can sit up in bed and appear stronger than I am. I pick up a book and begin reading it, upside down. I glance up, then flip the book right side up just before Helena enters. The mustached, monocle-wearing poser in a 3-piece suit is close on her heels, like a greedy dog at the hunt. Ah, you've gotten into some of the books. What did you choose? She tips it toward me slightly, reads the title, and cocks her head slightly. Pride and Prejudice, one of my favorites. I close the book and toss it on the table as though she'd just told me it was infected with plague. Yes, well, a man's gotta stay up on such things and appreciate the classics. The monocled man looks over at her impatiently, ready to get on with the visiting, away from the cripple in the spare bedroom.
"Patrick, this is Damien Webster. He's come from America to see you. He won't tell me what about."
She raises her eyebrows conspiratorially.
"Pleasure, Mr. Pierce. I knew your father."
"He's not courting her.
Wait, knew my father?" Webster seems to realize my confusion.
"We sent a telegraph to the hospital. Have you not received it?"
"My father is dead."
"But he didn't come here about that."
"What then?"
Helena speaks before I can.
"Major Pierce has been here for a month. The hospital receives a great many cables each day. What's your business, Mr. Webster?"
Her tone has grown serious. Webster glares at her. He's probably not used to a woman talking to him in such a tone. He could probably do with more of it.
"Several matters, the first being your father's estate."
Outside the window, a bird lands on the fountain. It fidgets, dunks its head, rises and shakes the water off.
"How did he die?" I say, still focused on the bird.
Webster speaks quickly, like it's something to get out of the way, an annoyance.
"Automobile accident. He and your mother both perished instantly. Dangerous machines, I say. It was quick. They didn't suffer, I assure you.
Now, I feel hurt of a different kind, a crushing feeling of loneliness, emptiness, like there's a pit inside me that I can't fill, like I'll never be happy again. My mother gone, buried by now. I'll never see her again.
Will that be acceptable, Mr. Pierce?"
"What?"
"The account at First National Bank in Charleston. Your father was a very frugal man. There's almost $200,000 in the account."
"Frugal to a fault."
Webster is clearly frustrated and plows on, hoping for a response.
"The account's in your name. There was no will, but as you've no siblings, there's no problem."
He waits another moment.
"We can transfer the money to a bank here on the continent."
He glances at Helena.
"Or England, if you prefer."
"The West Virginia Children's Home. It's in Elkins. See that they get the balance of the account, and that they know that it came from my father."
Yes, that's possible. May I ask why?"
A truthful response would be because he wouldn't want me to have it, or, more exactly, because he didn't like the man I've become. But I don't say either, maybe because Helena is in the room, or maybe because I don't think this shyster deserves an honest response. Instead, I mumble something approximating, "It's what he would have wanted."
He looks at my leg, searching for the right words.
"That's all well and good, but the army pensions are rather sparse, even for a major. I would think you'd be keen to keep a bit of the money, say $100,000?
I stare at him, full on now.
"Why don't you tell me what you're here about? I doubt it's my father's $200,000 estate."
He's taken aback.
"Of course, Mr. Pierce. I was only trying to advise for your best interests."
"Indeed, that's what I'm here about. I bring a message from Henry Drury Hatfield, governor of the great state of West Virginia. His Excellency wishes you to, well, first off, he sends his deepest condolences for your loss, indeed the state's and our great nation's. Additionally, he would like for you to know that he is prepared to appoint you to your father's seat in the U.S. Senate, as this authority has just been vested in him by the state legislature."
I'm beginning to realize how the McCoys could hate these snakes so much. Henry Hatfield is the nephew of Devil Hatfield, the leader of the infamous Hatfield clan. The governor can't run for a second term. He had himself set up for that U.S. Senate seat 2 years ago, but the states ratified the 17th Amendment the year before, allowing for direct election of the U.S. senators, yanking the power away from corrupt state legislatures and manipulators like Hatfield. My father was in the first class of U.S. senators elected by the people. His death and the talk of the money now make more sense, but not the appointment. Webster doesn't let the mystery linger long. He leans against the foot of the bed, speaking like we're old pals now.
"Of course, your status as a war hero will make you a popular choice. There will be a special election. As you know, senators are now elected by the people." He nods, as they should be.
"The governor is ready to appoint you to serve in your father's seat on the condition that you will endorse him in the special election and campaign for him. In return, he is willing to further support your career, perhaps as a congressional candidate. Congressman Patrick Pierce has a nice ring to it, I think." He pushes off the bed and smiles at me.
"So, can I give the governor the good news, then?"
I glower at him. I've never wanted to stand so much in my whole life, to be able to walk this demon to the front door and toss him out. I know the circumstances aren't ideal, but we must all rise to the occasion. Webster nods toward the leg. And with your limitations, it could be a good fit. You're not likely to find better work. Get out. Now, Mr. Pierce, I know you heard me. And don't come back. You got the only answer you're ever going to get. Tell that thug Hatfield to do his own dirty work, or maybe one of his cousins. I hear they're good at it. He steps toward me, but Helena catches him by the arm. This way, Mr. Webster. When he's gone, she returns. I'm very sorry about your parents.
As am I. My mother was very kind and very loving. I know she can see how sad I am now, but I can't hold it any more.
Can I bring you anything?
I can tell she didn't mean to, but her eyes dart to where the bottle would sit beside the bed.
Yes, a doctor. For my leg.
Chapter 74. Situation Room, Clock Tower HQ, New Delhi, India. Dorian lingered by the door, surveying the Situation Room. It looked almost like mission control for a NASA launch. Several rows of analysts were speaking into headsets and working computers that controlled the drones. On the long wall, a patchwork of screens showed telemetry from the drones, scenes of mountains and forests. Dmitri had been coordinating the search. The burly Russian looked as though he hadn't slept since the explosions in China. He pushed his way through the throngs of analysts and joined Dorian at the back of the room.
We've got nothing so far. There's just too much area to search.
What about satellite surveillance?
Still waiting on it.
Why? What's taking so long?
Repositioning takes time, and there's so much area to cover.
Dorian watched the screens for a moment. Start shaking the bushes.
Shaking?
Burning, Dorian said as he turned and led Dmitri to the door, out of earshot of the analysts.
See what falls out. My guess is Warner is in one of those monasteries. Where are we on Toba?
The bodies are on planes bound for Europe, North America, Australia, and China. The live ones are in local hospitals in India and,
he checked his watch,
Bangladesh within the hour.
Reports?
Nothing so far. At least there was some good news.
Chapter 75. The next morning, Milo was waiting for Kate, just as he had the previous morning. How long did he sit there, waiting for her to wake up? Kate rose and found the bowl of breakfast waiting in the same place. She and Milo exchanged their morning pleasantries, and he again led her to David's room. The journal lay on the table beside the bed, but Kate ignored it, moving first to David. She administered the antibiotics and inspected the shoulder and leg wounds. The rings of red had expanded in the night, spreading out to his chest and upper thigh. Kate chewed on the inside of her mouth and gazed absently out the window.
Milo, I need you to help me with something. It's very important.
As I said when first we met, madam,
he bowed again,
Milo is at your service.
Are you squeamish around blood, Milo?
Several hours later, Kate was securing the last bandage to David's shoulder. A pile of bloody gauze lay in a pool of blood and pus in a bowl on the table. Milo had performed admirably, not as well as an OR nurse, but his zen countenance had gone a long way, especially in keeping Kate's nerves in check. When she finished with the bandages, Kate ran a hand across David's chest and exhaled deeply. Now all she could do was wait. She leaned back in the alcove and watched his chest rise and fall, the motion almost hard to discern. After a few moments, she opened the journal and began reading. June 3rd, 1917.
How about now? Dr. Carlyle says as he presses the ink pen to my leg.
Yeah,
I say through gritted teeth.
He slides the pen down and jabs again.
And here?
Like the dickens.
He straightens and contemplates the result of his prodding. Before he looked at the leg, he spent some time collecting a history. It was a welcome departure from the field surgeons who looked at the injury, never at the man, and usually proceeded without a word. I told him I was 26, in otherwise good health, had no dependencies, and had gotten the wound in a tunnel that collapsed under the Western Front. He nodded and performed a thorough examination, noting that the injury wasn't that different to what he saw in miners and sportsmen in his practice. I wait for his verdict, wondering if I should say something. The city doctor scratches his head and takes a seat by the bed. I have to say, I agree with what the army surgeons told you. It would have been better to have taken it off then, probably just below the knee, or at least that's where I would have started. What about now? I dread the answer. Now, I'm not sure. You won't walk on it again, or at least not normally. Mostly it will depend on how much pain you have. There's a lot of nerve damage, no doubt. I would recommend you try walking, as best as you can manage, for the next month or two. If the pain is unbearable, as I suspect it will be, we'll take it below the knee. Most of the feeling is in the feet. There are more nerves there. This will give you some relief. As if anticipating my distress, he adds, we're not just fighting the pain here. Vanity is a factor. No man wants to lose half his leg, but it doesn't make him any less of a man. It's best to be practical. You'll be thankful you were, and I suppose the last consideration is what type of work you'll be doing, Captain. No, Major, was it? Never seen a Major your age. You make rank fast when everyone's dying around you, I say, stalling for time on the other question, one I've refused to face since the tunnel collapsed. Mining is all I know. I'm not sure what I'll do after I'm back on my feet. It's the first expression that comes to mind. Desk work would, benefit your disposition if you can find it. He nods and stands. Well then, that's all. Ring me or write in a month. He hands me a card with his address in London. Thank you, Doctor. Truly. Well, I couldn't very well deny a request from Lord Barton. We go all the way back to our days at Eton, and when he told me you were a war hero, and that his little girl was so insistent that he feared her heart would positively break if I didn't have a look, I was on the train the next day. There's a racket in the hall, like someone knocking something off a shelf. Dr. Carlyle and I both glance after it, but neither of us says anything. He gathers his black bag and stands. I'll leave instructions with Helena on how to wrap the leg. Good luck, Major. August 5th, 1917. 2 months have passed, and I've been walking for a month now, hobbling mostly. On good days with the use of a cane, limping. Carlyle came down a week ago to see my gimp performance. He stood beside Helena and cheered like a proud owner at a dog show. That's unfair and unkind to someone who's been nothing but kind to me. The pills, they dull the pain and everything else, including my thoughts. They make me immune to emotion when I'm on them, and ill as hell when they're wearing off. Fighting a war in my mind is a strange kind of torture. I think I much preferred shooting the Kaiser's men. At least I knew where I stood, and could get a moment's rest when I wasn't on the front. The weeks of walking, popping a pill, and plodding on have left me with another fear— that I'll never rid myself of this beast on my back, constantly goading me to nip the pain. I need the pills. Can't do without them. And don't want to. I've traded the devil, the laudanum, for two crutches, one at my side and one in my pocket. Carlyle says my walking will only improve as I learn the leg and find my minimum routine dose with the pain pills. It's so easy to say. But the pills aren't the thing I've grown most attached to in the months since I've left the hospital. She's like no one I've ever met. The idea of moving out, of saying goodbye, terrifies me. I know what I want to do. Take her by the hand, board a ship, and sail away from Gibraltar, away from the war, away from the past, and start over new, someplace safe, where our kids can grow up without a care in the world. It's almost 3 and I haven't taken a pill all day. I want my head clear when I talk to her.
I don't want to miss a thing, regardless of the pain in my leg or in my heart. I will need all my wits. Maybe it's her British upbringing with its stoicism and dry humor. Or maybe it's the 2 years of working in the field hospital, where emotions are just as contagious and dangerous as the infections they fight. But the woman is damn near impossible to get a read on. She laughs, she smiles, she's full of life, but she's never out of control. Never lets a word slip, never betrays her thoughts. I'd give my other leg to know how she really feels about me. I've been thinking about my options and making what arrangements I can. The day after that demon Damien Webster came to call, I wrote 3 letters. The first letter went to the First National Bank in Charleston, informing them to disperse the balance of my father's account to the West Virginia Children's Home in Elkins. I sent the second letter to the home, notifying them to expect a contribution, and that in the event the bequest does not reach them directly, they contact Mr. Damien Webster regarding the matter, as he was the last person known to have access to the account. I truly hope they will receive the funds. The final letter I wrote to the City Bank of Charleston, where my own funds are held. I received a reply letter 1.5 weeks later informing me that my account totaled $5,752.34, and that there would be a fee for sending the sum by a cashier's check to Gibraltar. I had fully expected to be nicked on my way out the door, as banks often do, and I replied immediately, thanking them and requesting they send said cashier's check with all possible haste. A courier came round yesterday with it. I also received the balance of my paltry army salary, most of which the army holds for you while you're off fighting. I was honorably discharged last week, so it's the last money that will arrive. All told, I have $6,382.79, a far cry from what I'll need to support a wife and set myself up. I'll have to find sedentary work, most likely something in banking or investing, possibly in something I know, mining, maybe munitions. But those kinds of jobs are only to be had by a certain type of man, with the right type of connections and the right type of education. If I had my own capital, I could make a go of it, and with a little luck, a strike. Coal, gold, diamonds, copper, or silver. Money wouldn't be a problem. $25,000 is the goal I've set. It won't give me much room for error. I hear Helena open the door, and I walk out into the small anteroom to greet her. Her nurse's uniform is covered in blood, and it strikes a strange contrast with the kind smile that spreads across her face when she sees me. I'd give anything to know if it was a smile of pity or one born of happiness. "You're up. Don't mind the clothes, I'm just going to change," she says as she rushes out of the room. "Put on something nice," I call to her. "I'm taking you for a walk, then dinner." She pops her head out from the door to her bedroom. "Really?" The smile has grown, and a hint of surprise has crept into it. "Shall I lay out your uniform?" "No, thank you, but I'm done wearing a uniform. Tonight is about the future." Chapter 76. Situation Room, Clock Tower HQ, New Delhi, India. Dorian paced the room, waiting to see the telemetry from the drones. The bank of screens sparkled to life one by one, revealing a monastery nestled in a mountainside. The technician turned to him. "Should we do a few passes to find an optimal target?" "No, don't bother. Hit it to the right of the base. Doesn't have to be exact. We mostly just want to set it on fire." "Have the other drone follow behind and film the aftermath," Dorian said. A minute later, he watched the rockets fly from the drone into the mountainside. He waited, hoping to see Kate Warner run out of the burning building. Chapter 77. Kate set down the journal and strained to see what was happening in the distance. It sounded like explosions. A rock slide? Earthquake? Past the farthest mountain range, smoke rose into the sky. White at first, then black. Could the Imari be looking for them? What could she do about it if they were? She gave David his afternoon dose of antibiotics and continued reading the journal to him. August 5th, 1917. Helena and I walk along the cobblestone wharf, enjoying the warm breeze from the sea and listening to the ships blow their horns as they enter the bay and dock at the harbor just beyond the row of shops and diners. The wooden harbor seems as small as a stack of toothpicks below the towering, jagged rock of Gibraltar. I put my hands in my pockets, and she slips her arm around mine, drifts closer to me, and synchronizes her stride with mine. I count it as a good sign. Gradually the lights come on along the street as the shopkeepers rouse from their Spanish-style siestas and return to prepare for the rush of dinner and evening shoppers. Each step twists the knife in my leg, or at least that's the sensation walking provides. I feel the sweat gathering on my brow from the dull agony, but I don't dare move an arm up to wipe it for fear she'll let go. Helena stops. She's seen it.
Patrick, are you in pain?
No, of course not. I wipe my forehead with my sleeve. Just not used to the heat. Being indoors under the fans has left me ill-adjusted. And I grew up in West Virginia to boot. She nods toward the rock.
It's cooler in the caves, and they have monkeys there. Have you seen them?
I ask her if she's joking, and she promises she isn't. I say we have time before dinner and let her lead me over there, mostly because she takes my arm again, and I'd walk anywhere at that point. The British sergeant gives us a personal tour of the pens they keep the monkeys in, deep inside St. Michael's Cave. Our voices echo as we talk. They call them Barbary macaques, and they are similar to macaques except without the tail. Apparently the Barbary macaques in Gibraltar are the only free-living primates in all of Europe. Well, besides humans, if the theory of evolution is to be believed, and I'm not certain I do. As we walk away toward dinner, I ask her how she knew about the monkeys.
They treat the sick ones at the British Naval Hospital, she says.
You're joking.
It's true.
Is it safe treating monkeys and humans in such proximity?
I assume it is. Can't imagine what kind of disease could jump from monkeys to humans.
Why go to all the trouble?
The legend is that as long as the macaques survive on Gibraltar, the British will rule it.
Yours are a very superstitious people.
Or maybe we're just keen to take care of anything we care about.
We stroll in silence for a while. I wonder if I'm like a pet to her, or a ward, or someone she owed some kind of debt to for saving her in the hospital. I'm losing my grip on the pain, and without a word, she stops, and still holding my arm, turns us back to face the rock as the sun sets across the bay.
There's another legend about the rock. The Greeks say it is one of the pillars of Hercules, and that the caves and tunnels under it extend deep into the earth, leading to the gates of Hades,
the gates of the underworld. She raises her eyebrows playfully.
You think it's down there?
No, I sort of doubt it. I'm pretty sure hell is 1,000 miles from here, in a trench on the western front. Her face grows serious, and she looks down. She was making a joke, and I was trying to be witty, but I reminded us of the war. It ruined the mood, and I wish I could go back and do the moment over. She brightens a bit and tugs at my arm.
Well, I, for one, am glad you're far away from there, and not going back.
I open my mouth, but she presses on, probably hoping to head me off from saying something dreary.
Are you hungry?
The wine comes, and I drink 2 glasses quickly, medicating. She drinks 1/2 glass, probably to be polite. I wish she would drink more. I'd love for that facade to break, if just for a moment, so I could see what she's thinking, how she feels. But the food is out, and we're both smelling it and saying how good it looks. Helena, I've been meaning to speak with you about something. It comes out way too serious. I had hoped to be casual, to disarm her. She sets her fork down and chews the small bite she's just taken, barely moving her jaw. I press on. It's been very decent of you to put me up. I don't know if I've said thank you, but I do appreciate it.
It's been no trouble.
It's been quite a bit of trouble. I haven't minded it. Nevertheless, I think I should get a place now that I'm out of my convalescence.
It might be prudent to wait. Your leg might not be fully healed. Dr. Carlyle said re-injury was a possibility as you walk more.
She pushes some of the food around on her plate. Not worried about my leg. People will talk, an unmarried man and woman sharing a home.
People always talk about something.
I won't have them talking about you. I'll find a place and work as well. I need to begin setting my affairs in order.
It would seem reasonable to wait until you knew where you were to work before making arrangements.
That's true.
She brightens a bit. Speaking of, there are some men who want to talk with you about a job. Some friends of my father.
To my dismay, I can't hide the anger in my voice.
You asked him to find me a job?
No, I promise you. I knew how you'd feel about it if I did, though I wanted to. He rang me about it a week ago, and they've been keen to see you. I put it off because I didn't know what your plans were.
Meeting with them couldn't hurt, I say. It was the worst mistake of my life. David could hear her reading, or someone reading, as he pushed the door to their studio apartment open. Allison looked up at him, walked over to the stereo, and pressed the pause button.
"You're home early," she smiled, and began washing her hands at the sink.
"Couldn't study." He motioned to the stereo.
"Another book on tape?"
"Yeah, makes cooking less boring."
She turned the sink off.
"I can think of something less boring than cooking."
He pulled her to him and kissed her on the mouth. She held her wet hands to her chest and struggled under his embrace.
"I can't. Hey, come on. They're moving my office tomorrow. I have to be there early."
"Oh, big investment banker lady getting a window office already?"
"Not a chance. Probably a cube next to the elevator."
"Or the bathroom."
"Let's hope not. It is on the 104th floor, though, so I can walk near the windows on my breaks, if they ever give me one."
"Exactly why you should live a little." He picked her up and threw her on the bed. He kissed her again and ran his hands down her body. She was breathing faster now.
"What time do you have class?"
"What's tomorrow?
Tuesday the 11th?
He pulls his sweater off. "Don't know, don't care.
Chapter 78 Press Release. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 1600 Clifton Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30333, USA. For immediate release, contact Division of News and Electronic Media, Office of Communication, 404-639-3286. New flu strain reported in villages in northern India. A new strain of flu called N24 Barang has been reported by India's Ministry of Health and Family Welfare. It is not yet known if the strain is a mutation of an existing flu strain or a completely new virus. The CDC has dispatched a field team to assist Indian health officials in analyzing the new strain. The outbreak was first reported among villagers outside Darchula, India. The severity and mortality rate of the new strain is also unknown at this time. The CDC has advised the State Department that no travel advisories are called for at this time. A follow-up press release will be issued when the CDC has more details about N24 Barang. Chapter 79 Milo wasn't waiting for Kate the next morning, but the bowl of breakfast porridge was there on the table, just as before. It was a little cold, but otherwise delicious. Kate wandered out of the wood-floored room into the hallway.
"Dr. Kate,"
Milo said as he jogged up to meet her. He stopped just short of her, put his hands on his knees, and panted until he caught his breath.
"I'm sorry, Dr. Kate. I had to work on my special project."
"Special project?" "Milo, you don't have to meet me every morning."
"I know. I want to,"
the teenager said as he regained his breath. They walked together down the open-air wooden passageways toward David's room.
"What are you working on, Milo?"
He shook his head.
"I cannot say, Dr. Kate."
Kate wondered if it was another prank.
When they reached David's room, Milo bowed and departed, sprinting in the direction he'd come from. David's condition had barely changed, although Kate thought maybe his color was returning. She gave him his morning antibiotics and pain pill,